I definitely do think that Wall Street is going to change as a result of this, but I don't think it's an easy populist story.
Hi, I'm Taylor Owen, and this is Big Tech. So this week's episode was going to be about something completely different. It was going to be on religion and technology. And that conversation will come to you in the next couple of weeks. But we decided to pivot because sometime last week, this happened.
Markets have been captivated since late last week with the phenomenon that is GameStop and the battle between short sellers and a group posting on Reddit with the stock shooting up and fluctuating wildly.
GameStop shares have now risen some 700% year to date.
We are seeing a phenomenon that I have never seen.
There's nothing normal about what you're seeing when it comes to this stock right now.
If your news feeds look anything like mine, you've probably been hearing a lot about GameStop over the past few weeks. In case you haven't, here's the gist. Essentially, there's a video game retailer called GameStop that's in almost every mall in America. But lately, business hasn't been booming, partly because you can download video games directly off the internet now, and partly, of course, because nobody really wants to go to the mall in the middle of a pandemic. So a bunch of Wall Street hedge funds tried shorting GameStop, which means they made a big bet on its stock going down. All of this is par for the course. But then it got interesting. A bunch of retail investors got together on a Reddit forum called Wall Street Bets, and they decided that if enough of them bought shares in GameStop, they could drive up the price of the stock. This is called a short squeeze, because you're squeezing the players who are doing the shorting. The more the stock goes up, the more money the shorters, in this case, the hedge funds, lose. And somewhat remarkably, this actually seemed to work.
Chaos continues on Wall Street as hedge fund titans lose billions to Reddit traders running amok.
Melvin's suffering losses upwards of 30% in the year through last Friday, a source told me. And it's my understanding that the P&L looked very grim before Citadel and Point72 gave Melvin a $2.75 billion cash infusion on Monday.
The story is a lot more complicated than that. But for now, that should give you a sense of what's going on here. Now, when I was first thinking of interviewing someone for this, I thought I would talk to an economist or a financial journalist, someone who could walk me through this story beat by beat. But over the last week, it seems like we've been inundated with these types of explainers. Given how quickly this became saturated, I decided I wanted to talk to someone with a very different perspective on all of this. I wanted to talk to Lana Swartz. Lana is the author of a book called New Money, about the ways in which digital technologies like Bitcoin are reshaping finance. Lana is a professor of media studies, so she brings a really unique perspective to all of this. Because while this is undoubtedly a story about finance, it's also a story about social media, about populism, and about Silicon Valley. The dominant narrative that has emerged around this is that of the Davids of Reddit conquering the Goliaths of Wall Street. Lana doesn't really buy that, but she does think it's an important moment for a variety of other reasons. It's an opportunity to take stock of our financial system as it currently exists, to think about who it's working for and against. It's a moment to look at the design of these new fintech platforms and how they are shaping our economy. And it's a moment that has the potential to really democratize finance. But 20 years ago, we thought the internet had the potential to be a truly democratizing force as well. And that never really came to fruition. Maybe this time we can get it right. Here's Lana Swartz.
I wanted to start with sort of your broad sense of what happened and how you understand what happened. I mean, what's your context for thinking about last week?
Yeah. So, you know, I was listening to another podcast that was trying to, do an explainer and kind of think through what has happened. And at the end, they did a little like take-a-thon where they just listed out all the takes. They're like, there's this take, there's that take, there's this take. And they kind of commented on each one. And the takes were pretty varied and about a lot of different things. And so as a as a scholar, as kind of a sociocultural scholar of communication technologies and particularly money technologies, I think that this is a really interesting moment, you know, to explore a lot of different issues. So, you know, I don't hold me to account to this, but I don't think we're going to necessarily see some major financial meltdown of systemic proportions in the next month or so. And that might be cause for some people to kind of dismiss this story and kind of act like it went away. But I do think, you know, even so, even after the news cycle has moved on, this has kind of brought up a lot of really important issues that I think, you know, are worth paying attention to. It's one of those moments of, you know, infrastructural scholars like myself like to talk about infrastructural inversions. So this idea when suddenly something stops working and you realize all the things that went into making it work in the first place. So this thing that you never noticed before and then suddenly
becomes visible, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a bit about how you got into this topic and what you've been working on really for the last decade leading up to this moment. So you're a professor of media studies, but you spent the better part of your career looking at cryptocurrencies and sort of broad forms of financial payment and what you call new money. So how did you get into that?
So I was in grad school, really in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. So this moment when suddenly lots and lots and lots of people became popularly interested in money. So, you know, where does the money go? You know, you have, you know, trillions of dollars of wealth wiped out overnight. You have, in turn, you know, relief and stimulus plans that introduce quantitative easing that create money seemingly out of thin air. You have popular interest in machinations of the stock market. So, you know, ranging from dark pools to collateralized debt obligations. It was also the emergence of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And so I kind of trace this moment not just to the global financial crisis, but also, you know, 2007, 2008 was almost also this moment where, you know, the iPhone first came out, followed quickly by the Android. So suddenly we were all carrying around like pretty sophisticated interconnected computers in our pocket. Facebook sort of hit the tipping point of really having enough users that it wasn't just young people. It wasn't, it was like even your grandma was on Facebook. So it was this moment. And then I argue that, you know, in order to do money, you really just need something to keep track of accounts, and you need a way to transmit information, and you need a way to connect with people, so to have some kind of address book. So between a cell phone or an advanced smartphone and something like Facebook, you're getting pretty close. So all the pieces were there for this kind of for this moment of ripe reimagining of what money is, what money could do. And you mentioned the media studies piece. Yeah. You know, people often ask me, like, what does media studies have to do with money? And I realized that, you know, so many of the new technologies that were, you know, and platforms that were emerging around consumer financial services were very much in the mode of Silicon Valley, were very much in the mode of social media. Yeah. So I began to really see this, like, deep entanglement between payment and Silicon Valley more broadly defined. And I sort of determined that I would, you know, get to the bottom of it and puzzle it all out.
So I imagine for much of your time working on this, whether it was cryptocurrencies or slight changes in retail investing, this was probably seen as pretty niche, particularly in like media studies, right? Where people are looking at social networks and journalism and all these sorts of things. How would you express the importance of new money in these transitions, and particularly now when we're immersed in this transition?
Right. So, I mean, it seems pretty niche, except for when you realize how many times a day and how frequently we rely on monetary infrastructures of various kinds, and how the invisible changes that they're going through may, in fact, impact us. So no matter what, I always tell scholars to, or and journalists, to kind of look for the payment angle, look for the payment infrastructure. You know, there's been a number of times, whether it was, you know, WikiLeaks or, you know, more recent issues with white nationalists in the US and elsewhere, where, you know, where various parties have been deplatformed, but it isn't really until the money gets cut off when the payment intermediaries begin to deplatform these groups.
And money underlies a lot of the activity of those groups too.
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of this is just commercialization.
So it's important to ask, you know, how does the money get to these groups? Mm. You know, what are the you know, what are the actual infrastructures that money travels through? Mm. You know, how do those infrastructures wield infrastructural power? So I actually was most fascinated and really perked up when it was Shopify, the e-commerce system, deplatforming some of these white nationalist groups, because that's actually where take away the money and you know, that's where some of the deplatforming really has teeth, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was hilarious. Even sort of the late night comedians were talking about that when they would list the long deplatform, like all the different companies that deplatformed in the end, they were like, and Shopify, like what's going on there? And yet that's probably the most powerful lever, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So there are always these moments where these kinds of infrastructure and these kinds of much bigger structural problems and dynamics, as you say, reveal themselves. And I think it's pretty clear that that is partly what happened and yet last week. I mean, we had this moment of visibility of some of this infrastructure, which is really interesting. It seems to me there's two big technology elements to what was going on. One was clearly the innovation happening in retail investing with apps like Robinhood, which is a relatively new phenomena, I think. But the other is social media. That there was literally a social media component to this. Not just money as media, but that this was happening on platforms. So I want to start with that a little bit and get some of your thoughts on that, if that's possible. So what was the Wall Street Bets subreddit?
Yeah, so Reddit is kind of a message board of message boards. So it's a site filled with all of these communities called subreddits. And each of those subreddits are devoted to a particular topic. And Wall Street Bets was or is a place for people to come on and kind of, am I allowed to use profanities on this podcast?
Of course.
Okay. Well, as they call it, shitpost about Wall Street. And Wall Street Bets is interesting because it's not your average, you know, sitting around talking about the market. Rather, it is full of, you know, really absurdist humor, full of memes, full of, you know, far more profanities and offensive language than even if I'm allowed to, I probably won't use on this. Mm. And I had been paying attention to it ambiently for a couple of years now. It's sort of in my wheelhouse. Mm. What's funny about this is that it's a place where you go to be with other people who think that the stock market is really funny and enjoy placing kind of stupid bets, like literally gambling. You know, they use a lot of ableist language, but basically to say, let's get really stupid with our money and just go all in. So like quite absurdist and to me interesting because it you know, in science and technology studies and in kind of social studies of finance, we've all kind of long argued that the market is an engine, not a camera, right? So, you know, there's this classical economic idea that the market is a truth claim on reality and that, you know, the economy goes up and, you know, a company does good and its stock goes up and it's all very rational and it's all very reflective of something real that's out there. But, you know, those of us in my academic world, the market itself is actually an engine, right? It's not a camera taking a picture of something out in the world. Rather, it is its own performativity. Mm. It's its own machine that may or may not have anything to do with what you or I, who are just, you know, shopping and working at our jobs and living our lives, like think of and experience of as the economy. Mm. And I think Wall Street Bets actually, behind all of the offensive absurdism, they really get that. And they're sort of, you know, offering a critique of the stock market as itself fairly absurd.
And performative.
And performative, indeed, yeah. At the same time, though, there's this rapid oscillation. Like, they like to, almost jokingly, talk about the fundamentals and say, you know, actually, they, as they put it, like, I like the stock. Like, they actually sometimes are willing to make bets based on their analysis of what's going to happen in the world. But I do think, you know, understanding this deep ambivalence and rapid oscillation between absurdism and earnestness is crucial, not just to understanding Wall Street bets, but to understanding all kinds of turns that we've seen in politics and kind of culture more broadly.
But that to some degree complicates the narrative that this is a rising populist movement overtaking the injustices of free market capitalism, right? Like, if this is performative and for show and was a game in many respects, is that telling us something different than this narrative that's taken hold?
Well, I do think that narrative that has taken hold of, like, the little guy versus Wall Street has a lot of problems. And, you know, first of all, you know, there is professional money on both sides of this. There are actual hedge funds and institutional investors of all kinds who are also putting money into going long on GameStop. So and we don't really know how much. We can't follow the money here exactly, but we do know that there are professional money on both sides. So the populism story, I mean, and that is to say, there are definitely little guys. There are definitely people who are putting hundreds of dollars into this. But there are a lot of people who we would not recognize as a populist little guy. The populist figure here in many ways is Elon Musk, who is famously against hedge funds because hedge funds have shorted Tesla and has been very public about his disdain for hedge funds. And so, you know, you do absolutely see memes about Elon Musk where they call him, you know, Daddy Elon. They talk about, like, for king and country in reference to Elon Musk that do look to me quite a bit like some of the memes we saw in the Donald about Donald Trump so many years ago where, you know, they called him sort of allegedly jokingly this mix of cynicism and absurdism and true belief, like God Emperor. So it's
very
interesting.
So what you're saying is Elon Musk is the next Donald Trump. Is that not to put words in your mouth, but
yeah, I mean, and then it's the same question of, like, do they really mean it? Are they really joking? You know, how do the kind of vectors of cynicism and true belief and absurdism shake out here? The other hitch to the populist story is that, you know, everyone on Wall Street Bets is saying, you know, as they call it, like, diamond hands, which means hold the stock, do not sell. Hold it so hard until your fists turn into diamonds. The other side of that is what they call poop hands, which is where you can't hold, you get scared, you think the price is dipping, so you sell it, and then, you know, you don't really have the moxie or cojones or whatever you'd want to call it to ride the roller coaster and hold on tight. So while the main discourse on the subreddit right now is diamond hands, don't sell your GameStop, keep it going, hold it. Many of the people who are savvy retail investors who've been around this for a long time, who have put quite a bit of money into GameStop, are not actually willing to lose hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars for the sake of diamond hands, for the sake of proving that they have the cojones to play this game of chicken against hedge funds. And many of them have, in fact, sold out, sold their stock. They're probably not making memes about it. In fact, I haven't seen many memes about it. But they have turned the GameStop stock worth, quote unquote, X amount of money into actual money. whereas others who I think maybe sit on the side of true belief, maybe are less savvy, maybe just don't, like, are so absurdist and cynical that they don't care if they lose money, are still holding on. And eventually, I can't see an end strategy where many of those users who continue to hold and hold and hold don't wind up losing their investment.
So are they the people who are going to get hurt in this?
Yes, yes. So there are absolutely going to be people who bought at the top of the market for GameStop, who believe the hype of hold, and who are only going to be able to sell after their position has totally collapsed and when the stock is worth almost nothing again. You know, I come to this in part through my research in the Bitcoin community and crypto community more broadly. And in Bitcoin, we have a similar dynamic where Bitcoiners talk about hodling. So it's a misspelling of the word hold. So you're meant to hodl, and hodl your Bitcoin. Don't sell. And some people who are preaching hodling are absolutely selling, many people, because they are trying to get out at the top of the market.
Right. If they weren't, then it wouldn't be fluctuating the way it does radically.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. So yes, they are able to screw some hedge funds, so to speak. But I don't see any way for there not to be some ordinary Joes who wind up getting hurt by this. I haven't seen a clearly articulated exit strategy.
Hmm. So this connection to cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin sort of brings up the potential democratizing elements of this or empowering elements of this. And 5 or so years ago, I wrote an article about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies where I kind of made the argument that either, this could be totally wrong, but I just want to try it on you, either, either this technology is as fundamentally empowering as proponents are making it out to be, in which case it undermines the very thing that makes nation states the strongest, which is their control over currency. And states are pretty powerful. So they are probably going to push back very aggressively against this technology. Or it's actually not as powerful as the people promoting it are. It's what you're calling, it's generally just a pump and dump scheme to game the market, an investment, in which case the states are just going to kind of let it emerge and simmer and aren't going to use their big sticks against it. Is what we're seeing now kind of an example of the latter, that this isn't overturning capitalism or the state? This is just a sort of niche market thing that is being controlled by the same kind of interests who generally control investments.
I actually think it's a third thing. I don't think we're seeing the emergence of some radical democratization of finance where suddenly, you know, it's a vast army of, you know, this distributed ad hoc hedge fund, mm-hmm. essentially to rival entrenched actors. I don't think we're going to see any major systemic market meltdowns from this anytime soon. But I think that a better comparison is actually to the internet more broadly. Mm. So, you know, in the early days in the 90s, there was a lot of talk about how the cyberspace was going to leave behind the meat space and its petty rules and petty governments. And we were all going to be homesteading on the electronic frontier and living in this, you know, radically new, imagined world that was, you know, virtual world. And to some extent, it's true that the internet has challenged many of the laws that terrestrial governments put in place. But instead, you know, we haven't as yet gotten the revolution that is as, you know, dramatic as may have been promised or envisioned in the 90s. Instead, what we got was a bunch of platforms who carved up the internet and, you know, definitely made it far from this kind of libertarian utopia that it once was envisioned to be. But our lives have radically been reshaped by the internet. Mm. You know, Facebook is really important. It is an important intermediary that in some ways rivals state power, but it also is the place where we go to communicate with our grandma. You know, it's the place where we go to sell things. It's the place where we go for news, for everything. So I think that, you know, democratization of finance is absolutely here to stay, and that we will see finance change in the way that almost all other industries have changed as a result of, the internet facilitating new actors. I don't think, again, that it's necessarily this radical populist story about the little guy. I think it's maybe a new way for MBA grads to act on the stock market, you know, a new way for the same kinds of people who've always been players to enter into it, maybe disrupting the hierarchies inside of Wall Street firms more than anything else.
Interesting.
So I definitely do think that Wall Street is going to change as a result of this, but I don't think it's an easy populist story.
Or even democratizing? I mean, if this is just an innovation within the financial services sector,
right,
then that's not really democratizing either, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the question there is actually a question of platforms. So, you know, this is something I think quite a bit about with payment systems, but also, you know, because I'm in media studies, we think about the governance and power of platforms constantly. Mm. So, you know, platforms fundamentally moderate. They fund what that's like definitionally what they do. They decide how information and activity flows through them. They're far from these, you know, neutral dumb pipes or dumb channels.
Yep.
And Robinhood is fundamentally a platform. You know, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories that have emerged since they have kind of stopped allowing certain kinds of trades on their platform in the wake of all of this. But I do think that they have been largely constrained. I do think that the main reason why they stopped allowing people to buy GameStop is because they were constrained by a variety of different market mechanisms, like their own credit, their own ability to clear the trades that were being placed. And I think what that reveals, that kind of infrastructural inversion, is that, you know, we have to simultaneously hold platforms accountable because platforms will fundamentally shape whether or not this is a democratizing moment or what the nature of that democratizing moment is. But we also have to stop. We have to stop making these like sweeping generalizations about platforms as though their moderation decisions were on-off switches. But to really intensely study the underlying infrastructure that produces platform decision making. Mm. So I think that all of the work that has been done over the last decade or so to understand platforms now has to be applied to platforms like Robinhood, and to see like if there is something different about money, and if so, what is it? Is there more of a do they owe us more of a fiduciary role? But how can we understand the mechanisms by which they are in fact constrained? Mm.
I mean, that segues perfectly. I want to ask you about platforms. I mean, the analogy to the internet is important, I think. And you could argue that the emergence of platforms as an infrastructure, and particularly as a set of incentives, is part of what maybe pushed back against the democratizing nature of our previous internet infrastructure. And so I guess, what can we learn from that the platformatization of the internet is what led to it being less democratic and empowering. So what can we learn from that to apply to these new set of platforms that are going to come very fast, right? Robinhood's not the first here, or not the last, and they're going to be barreling down.
So here's the thing about Robinhood, is it is like every other platform, every other startup in the Valley, you know, it is funded by VCs. It has an eventual data play, like, oh, it's free to use. It's free to our users because we are going to figure out how to monetize this data somehow eventually. But I suspect that its real exit plan was never actually to sustainably monetize that data, but instead was preparing for an eventual acquisition, you know, by a big bank or the like. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that in you know, the tech industry, it seems like we have no real way to imagine long-term business that actually serves the consumers that isn't acquisition or winner takes all in the way of Facebook, where you just become so entrenched that you know,
you're a natural monopoly.
Even if you're not making any money, even if you're largely still, you know, moving and, you know, operating in what's called growth mode, you know, just trying to get to scale, and profits come later. And in many cases, disrupting businesses that actually do make a profit. So this doesn't actually look very much like what I was taught capitalism is. So as the tech industry becomes ever more imperial and ever more turning its project to more and more parts of life and more parts of the economy, how can we hold them accountable to make businesses that actually try to serve the users, not just get to scale and exit somehow? And I think that's a really big and unanswerable question, but is kind of the key question of the moment.
And I suppose if we want to change some of those incentives, part of what we might want to do is not leave this space entirely unregulated as we did the previous platform moment. But it strikes me one of the really hard parts of regulating this sector is going to be figuring out how to protect these retail investors and the banking infrastructure and the integrity of the financial sector while not impeding the ability of the retail investors and these new platforms to emerge. Do you think there's a set of regulatory approaches that can help ease that transition?
Yeah, I honestly can't say that I know that there are, but I think that that's a really good agenda, for policy scholars to like really think about. And that's definitely a conversation I would be interested in being part of. I do think that some of the messaging, the political messaging in response has been really interesting. So, notably Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been sort of a supporter. She seems to sort of get it. But when Elizabeth Warren popped up and said something like, we need to talk about regulating this space because, this kind of activity, like including both the way that Robinhood treated its users, but also the way that the potentially like swarming behavior that these retail investors caused doesn't actually help GameStop. It doesn't make for an efficient market. It doesn't... that isn't really good either. It was kind of the like grown-up approach from what I can tell.
Well, it was also from her consumer protection background, right?
Absolutely.
She's like, how do we protect these people from making mistakes in a system?
Right, right.
I mean, in somewhat paternalistic way. Whereas AOC is all about democratic empowerment and this is...
Yeah.
So it's interesting to watch the progressive world struggle
split
with this topic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I do think, important thing that is worth teasing out here too, is the role, and I almost hate myself for saying this, but the role that hedge funds actually play in an efficient market. Like if we're going to say that there's such a thing as a market and we're going to allow some people to, invest money and we're going to pull all of our retirement funds in it and we're going to play all these casino games, hedge funds do play a role. Like they're the folks that say, this stock is overvalued, right? This thing is hype. I hope if any Wall Street Bets people listen to this, they may actually get mad at me for kind of pulling in the Elon Musk of it all again. But Tesla, if we pretend that the market is in fact kind of a camera that's meant to take a picture of real events, Elon Musk is a very erratic personality.
And maybe you want a bit of hedging against the exuberance attached to his stock, right?
Maybe. Yeah. Yes. Maybe it's okay to say that is overvalued and maybe a check on some of the just exuberant growth to the moon, as Bitcoiners and also Wall Street Bets people would say, it's could we imagine, this is kind of ridiculous, but could we imagine like some alliance between like hedge funds and something like the degrowth movement, which seeks to put a check on economic growth or like an ideology of economic growth for reasons of ultimately environmental, avoiding environmental catastrophe. I mean, that's
a political
ridiculous
alliance that is...
but that's stranger bedfellows have been made in this very controversy. So you never know. I think, there's this a moment where we have this miasma of strange bedfellows and all kinds of new allegiances are going to emerge. Probably not that one, But as a provocation, I think it's pretty interesting.
So do you think that's what might make this a real turning point?
Yeah, I mean, I have an inner hedge fund in me where I'm always the one being like, is it really going to change that much? Probably not. And I think that, you know, we're going to see change in this space. And we're going to see, you know, Wall Street has changes coming for it. But they probably won't be as exciting or as exciting in a good way as some people hope. I don't know. I'm not a good prognosticator. I'm more of a historian and an analyst of what's going on.
Well, I tell you, you probably did some great perspective on what we've all been watching unfold over the past week. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
That was my conversation with Lana Swartz. As always, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at taylor@bigtechpodcast.com. Big Tech is presented by the Center for International Governance Innovation and produced by Antica Productions. Please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We release new episodes on Thursdays every other week.